The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
So here we are, circa 2016, and we've papered over the problems in Europe, we've papered over the problems in the United States, we've papered over the problems in China, and we haven't met these challenges with any real structural change or reform, in large part because we've had massive amount of central bank intervention precluding real declines in asset values and a wipeout of bad debts.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, as we're closing out this year and going into the new year, I think it would be a good time for us to say thank you to our loyal, amazing group of listeners. I was just looking through these questions and answers that we're going to be going through today and next week, and I'm just very humbled that so many really intelligent, connected, engaged people are listening to the show on a weekly basis.
Well, and there's quite a few new listeners, and I'm very excited about that. But I'm also very grateful for the folks that have been listening 5, 6, 7, 8, almost 10 years now.
Yeah.
And it's been a great exercise for us, sort of continually vetting ideas and as a part of our own continuing education process, exploring new ideas with new people and new guests and keeping the conversation as broad as possible. But I hope that, and it appears from the feedback that we get from our listeners, old and new, that it's a vital part of their own education process.
Well, and don't you appreciate the constructive criticism? You know, if there's something that we say where they go, you know, I don't know that I fully agree with that, or could you elaborate further? That's welcome.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And even though it's not question and answer all year round, we would encourage those emails to keep coming.
I agree with that completely.
Well, why don't we go ahead and just go right into the questions. The format of the show will be very similar to what we've done over the last 8 or 9 years, which is I'll read the question to you, Dave, and then I think I'd like to just go ahead and chat with you a little bit afterwards about what your thoughts are on each question.
And we'll just reference the person who's asking the question by their first name only.
That sounds good. And this email comes from Brandon. Dear Dave and Kevin, I know you've reiterated that with both stock and bond markets overvalued now, it's time to be in cash. And the best cash is ounces. That sounds like a quote from you, Dave. However, I have assets in a company 401k that has no precious metals option and only a money market for cash, which I know has recently been coerced into investing in government bonds. The funds available to me are by sector, and for each sector, there is a managed option and a passive or index option. On a show some time ago, I know you related a story of speaking to a woman on an airplane and explaining that while money managers might realize a market is overvalued, they wouldn't sideline a client or their money for the fear that they missed out on gains of a market. Even if it's going to become more overvalued, they don't want to be out of it. On a more recent show, you mentioned that with volatility coming, people were moving out of managed funds to the Vanguard model at exactly the wrong time. Could you please expound on the nuances of your view of the advantages and disadvantages of managed versus passive funds?
Well, on the first point, dealing with the 401k allocations, I think it's important to look at overall asset allocation and see kind of where your dollars are being invested. I think generally speaking, we can talk about assets one of two ways, either liquid assets only, or in terms of total net worth, which might include non-liquid assets as well, whether that's a home or rental property or something like that in the real estate category.
Right.
Liquid assets we've talked about in terms of being divided in thirds, a third in stocks and bonds, a third in cash, and a third in precious metals. And again, that's for liquid assets. If you're including the illiquids, then you might do something a little bit different. 25% real estate, 25% stocks, 25% gold and silver, 25% cash. And so that issue of having the money market option there in the 401k, that might be a reasonable option to make up a part of your cash allocation, whether it's the one third that we talk about in reference to the perspective triangle, or say a 25% allocation if you're talking about total net worth. And so while I don't particularly think the course for government bonds is going to be a healthy one over the next 5 to 10 years, you can argue that in a money market fund, they're going to be in short-term paper.
Right.
And so you won't see a lot of price volatility. Where you see massive price volatility in bonds and government bonds is at the long end of the curve. If you're talking about paper that's dated 15, 20, 25 years, 30-year paper, this is where anything basically north of 10-year treasuries, you're going to see a lot more price volatility with a rise in interest rates.
Well, and if a person is putting money privately into gold outside of the 401k, then that's going to give them an offset of the devaluation of the cash or some of the bond volatility anyway.
Right. So when I look at the asset allocation, it makes sense to me to use the 401k dollars because you don't necessarily have great options otherwise to use that as a large part of your cash allocation.
Right.
Now you're thinking about your assets in total, retirement and non-retirement, and a part of that cash allocation can be made up by that mutual fund or money market mutual fund, as it were.
Okay, but the second part of the question was talking about the view of the advantages and disadvantages of managed versus passive funds. David, being a money manager, what's your feeling on just this new move towards passively turning over funds during a period of time that may be one of the most volatile times that we've been in 10 years?
Well, it's very interesting because the overwhelming evidence for a passive approach comes from the last 5 years' performance, where your big indexes have been driven largely by a few names, that is a few companies, and the performance has been much better than your managed alternatives. In fact, if you look at the last 3 to 5 years of hedge fund performance, arguably the best and brightest coming out of Wall Street to make a name for themselves and do their own thing, they have underperformed the market considerably over the last 3 to 5 years.
Right.
How is it that the best and brightest, who for 20 years have outperformed the market, are now underperforming the market? And again, that overwhelming evidence for taking a passive approach also sort of collects and concentrates here on the last 3 to 5 years as well. Now, we're going to predicate the future on the past, right? Wall Street has taught you that you shouldn't do that, and I would agree, you can't predicate future results based on past performance. And I would say that to say the last 3 to 5 years is an indication of the way that you should be investing, I would have a problem with that. If you look at bull market dynamics, if you are in a typical bull market, there are degrees of outperformance or underperformance in various sectors and in various asset classes. And being thoughtfully engaged in that process, I think a money manager will do a very good job of that. Now, there's a difference, though, between the bull market that we've just went through and past bull markets, and that is that this one has been driven primarily by central bank liquidity. And there's less discrimination of quality. There's less discrimination of risk. And this is, I think, very important. Everything moves. Everything moves if a central bank is the primary support of a bull market. And so you see passive investing work very well in a context
of central bank control.
That's right. We're actually, and I'm using discrimination clearly in the case of just looking at risk and looking for quality and a growth profile that is compelling and holding risk and reward in balance. That kind of discriminating analysis has been useless for 5 years. It has not paid extra, I mean, in terms of total returns, for that extra work. And so I would encourage any investor to back away and say, is it really true that in the last 100 years, doing extra work to understand risk and reward and to understand the opportunity that's put in front of you is not worth it?
Well, wouldn't you say this last 5 years has been the grand experiment of central banks nationalizing the markets? Now, that grand experiment cannot continue to work for forever. It's driven by debt. It's driven by manipulations of the markets. They can only do that so long. But at this point, it's still important to continue to realize the value of measuring risk or hiring somebody who understands that value.
Which goes back to your first comment, Kevin, which is that we are at the end of one of these experiments, not at the beginning.
All right.
And the longer you stay in this game, the more risk there is that I'm assuming in the market. We've talked about this in numerous ways from various vantage points over the last year. Price to sales, the stock market's never been higher.
Right.
Never. Not in the entire history of the stock market. Price to earnings were about the third most expensive.
Tobin's Q,
second or third most expensive market in history.
Right.
And so you'd have to say, you know, going into a period of time where I would assume that there's an increase in volatility an increase in volatility, because that's typically what comes after a stretch of growth. You see the market breathe in and breathe out. It's normal to have periods of growth followed by periods of consolidation. And that period of consolidation, is that really the kind of environment that you want to be in on autopilot, which is where I would see passive investing being, you know, again, if we're talking about a low stress way to approach the market and we're in the early stages of a bull market and you don't want to have to worry about paying extra money, getting a little extra performance, then I think passive investing has an interesting intrigue. But again, it's for its simplicity, not necessarily for how well it does.
But you sure don't want to be at the top of a market when that passive investing strategy is being employed.
There's three questions that you have to answer if you're going to be looking at a managed option. Who, how, and why? And if you can't answer who, how, and why, I'm not saying that just any manager is better than no manager. In fact, no management is probably better than most management, but there are managers out there who do an excellent job. The who is important, the how is important, what is their methodology, and why are they doing what they're doing.
And do they philosophically match your worldview?
Well, and the reality is the who, how, and why are irrelevant questions in this last 3 to 5 year time frame. So again, I'm being encouraged by the market and by current studies on passive versus managed approaches to basically check my brain at the door. And I think that's a very dangerous thing to do. And yet that is what has paid for the last 5 years, is to be disengaged, to not look at the fundamentals, and basically to allow central bank liquidity to float all boats.
The next question comes from Joe. He says, a couple of questions for the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Number one, with the world going more and more toward a cashless society, doesn't this undermine the investment case for physical gold and silver? Wouldn't gold and silver be outlawed too? And then I'll go ahead and give you the second question, and you can jump back, Dave. He says, number two, as an avid listener to the commentary and an avid reader of Don McIlvaney's Intelligence Advisor, I sense that Don's view of the world is a bit more dire than David's. Is my perception correct?
Yeah, I think we'll try to take both of those in stride. And I think there are many reasons to own gold. One is a cash alternative. A second would be as a growth vehicle. Third, as an asset which is private and portable. Fourth, one that became very popular during the global financial crisis, is that gold is a non-encumbered asset. It's an asset that's in the financial system, but it does not have counterparty risk. So I think, you know, in answer to Joe's question, if we're moving more towards a cashless society, does this undermine the investment case for physical gold and silver? I think it may undermine the second of the four that I just mentioned, which would be gold as a growth vehicle, because you may be dealing with a limitation in terms of your ability to liquidate the physical asset. On the other hand, you may see an increase in capital gains tax rates, things like that, which would dampen the role that it plays as a growth vehicle. As a private and portable transactable asset that you can take and use anywhere in the world, does it still have a merit? Yes. As a cash alternative, does it still have a merit? Yes, and you just have to be comfortable probably operating in the black market. And as a non-encumbered asset with no counterparty risk, does it still have its merits? Yes. So I would say if you're only focusing on it as a growth vehicle, then it may be impaired. But from the standpoint of 1, 3, and 4, those other reasons to own gold from an investment standpoint, I think it's still warranted.
Well, and Dave, can I just mention, sometimes people think, well, gosh, it'll be a cashless society, I can't buy gold. But actually, the way gold is purchased through us, it's already acting as if it's in a cashless system. When someone buys gold from us, their check or wire comes into our bank account, that's cashless. And when they liquidate gold later, we send a check or a wire back to them. That's cashless. People will probably still be buying and selling almost everything that they currently are buying and selling, even in a cashless society. Gold just allows you not to be trapped in that system.
I think the question made me reflect on something that I haven't in a while, which is an older book by Anthony Sutton.
Oh, yeah. The War on Gold.
I think it's worth noting that the war on gold has been around for a long time. And arguably, the war on gold started several centuries ago with the popularity of fiat money.
Right.
So there has been sort of a negative bias against gold and silver for a long time. The cashless society is kind of an extension of the trend, a slippery slope, if you will, having gone from fiat to now something that is completely controlled and transparent from a top-down perspective. So this is the question I would have. If gold and silver are no longer relevant, then why is the asset not just ignored? If in fact it is very relevant and is not only a signal, but is of deep importance, then I think you would see a movement against it,
right?
Because again, if it's irrelevant, it can be just ignored. But if it is relevant in the financial system and as a cash alternative, then I think you can assume that there will be a continuation of the war on gold.
Well, and you know, the war on gold was written in the 1970s when the war on gold was very, very intense. You know, speaking of the second question with Don, Don takes a more dire view according to this listener. What's your thought on that? Don's actually seen a pretty intense war on gold and come out the victor on the other side.
Right. Well, I mean, gold is the antithesis to a command and control economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's safe to assume that there will be a war against it, as there has been for a couple hundred years. You know, Don's perspectives often tie to something that are historical in nature and sometimes even eschatological in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the divergence in our views, as I prefer the historical cycles to something of a more apocalyptic nature. So Don's focus tends to be on gold and on the current issues which could lead to crisis. His talent, I think, is putting the pieces of the puzzle together and then being able to speak to what he sees with a prophetic voice.
Mm-hmm.
And my focus has probably been more on what is next. That's not to say gold becomes less relevant. It remains relevant. But I think there are other asset classes that become more compelling at the right value exchange.
Right.
And so I'm looking for the future value exchange, which means that I'm always looking forward as well as trying to learn as much as I can from the past.
I've worked for both of you, and you guys are a great complement to each other, because Don actually is looking at how do you preserve assets in the present, right now. You're looking decades ahead, and you're going, okay, once we've preserved those assets, how do we employ them in something that's constructive for future generations?
Well, and a part of that is because I'm hardwired to think about future generations. My point of emphasis is on fixing problems, and really that being from a grassroots level. Why am I unimpressed with a particular political outcome? Because I have been through enough political seasons to see that it's kind of a game between the red shirts and the blue shirts, and whoever's in office, what they have is an advantage of rhetoric for at least the first 100 days, and then actions have to be borne out. And so what I'm more interested in is solutions from a grassroots level, which individuals can put in motion and be in control of, not sort of harboring hope that this politician or that will be different this time and sort of stand out above the rest in terms of the historical record. This is why I wrote the book, Kevin, The Intentional Legacy, because I think that family life is foundational to cultural change.
Mm.
If you look at the political system that we have, it suggests that there are macro solutions that need to trickle down to the micro level. And I would argue the exact opposite.
Right.
I would say that there are micro solutions which will trickle up to the macro level.
So instead of the government being the ultimate solution, the family is the ultimate solution. And then the trickle up approach is actually what happens from family up to the top.
That's right. And I'm neutral in terms of being encouraged or discouraged on a Trump victory in this election. It's going to give some people the impression that all our problems can be solved, and that's going to happen from a top down. Again, where I would disagree is just that you can't control that process, whereas you can have more of an influence looking at solutions from a grassroots level. So again, how does this tie into Don's perspective versus mine? I think Don is very focused on the present tense, and where he does focus on the future, it tends to be in terms of an end times appraisal. And my perspective on the future is very different. This is the only arena, you know, I'm talking about family again, where the variables in play can be continually influenced by our choices. And that to me is very powerful, not only from a family cultural perspective, but ultimately from a larger cultural perspective as well.
Dave, this next question is from Nathan. 8 years ago, the housing bubble burst. As a result, the Fed has pumped a lot of money into the system. Now the stock market has been going bonkers. The real economy seems to be finally turning the corner. Some would make an argument that all the stimulus is finally starting to hit the real economy and that there's a lot of upside ahead, both for the real economy and for the stock market. Now, others would make the case, like you do, that there are a lot of troubling indications and that all is not well, and that a downturn could be just around the corner. When you look at the current situation, what is it that makes you bearish instead of bullish?
Well, I'm always talking to the kids about differences between meanings of words, and I draw a big difference between the word intelligent and the word clever. And there are very intelligent men and women running some of the best businesses in the world today. But what has been driving success over the last several years is cleverness, not intelligence.
And other people's money. I hate to say it, but debt and other people's money.
Well, sure. But I mean, when I look at the amount of financial engineering, which has created the corporate growth, which we've seen of late, I would say this is a very temporary success story. And it's not tied to what drives growth over longer periods of time. If you were talking about major productivity gains, if you were talking about demographic shifts, if you were talking about a commodity boom, I mean, there are things that you can categorically say drive corporate growth, drive economic growth. And what we have, in fact, had is a tremendous amount of financial engineering.
Like share buybacks.
Well, sure. So if you look at the variables, and Nathan's right, we do tend to look at a certain set of variables. It's worrisome to me when what is driving earnings growth are share buybacks, what are driving bottom line growth for corporations, tax arbitrage, and just basically leveraging up their balance sheets. So, you know, again, when you look at the role that financial engineering has played, it's something that, again, goes back to that distinction between cleverness and intelligence. An intelligent approach to managing a business would be towards setting a trajectory that gives them 15, 20 years of runway, future growth, future sales, future earnings, future accumulation of market share. And what we have right now is, again, leverage, tax arbitrage, buybacks, things that you can put in the category of financial engineering. And that, to me, is categorically cleverness, which I put a lot less stock in. So, you know, why are we bullish versus bearish? This comes back to an earlier question. There are periods of excess, and those periods of excess are followed by periods of deficiency. In other words, there is a balance between, you know, sort of good years and bad years, growth and decay or decline, if you will. And you can see that from a long-term perspective, that the stock market typically is up about 60% of the time in a bullish trend. It's in a bearish contractionary trend 40% of the time. And the bearish side of me does tie to this. If you say that booms and busts are two sides of the same coin, we've been flipping the coin now for about 7 years and have been getting a bullish outcome, a bullish outcome, a bullish outcome,
right,
a bullish outcome. And that's not to say that you can't have, theoretically, an infinite number of coin tosses, which are all one way, but the probabilities of that actually are not real high.
Well, and you have to look at causes, and you've been pointing that out. The cause that that quarter's been coming up, you know, you can't change the laws of physics in the long run, but a person can cheat. What they can do is they can weight the dice. Using a die instead of a coin. You can weight the die. And the die has been weighted based on quantitative easing and artificially low interest rates. And a lot of these artificial engineering mechanisms of share buybacks, none of those employ a long-term foundational growth model.
So what makes me bearish instead of bullish? We can look at the U.S. and say that relative to the rest of the world, our performance is much stronger. But I look at the whole world as being interconnected. I mean, this is one of the consequences, for better and for worse, of globalization. And you've got global trade, which is in free fall. So again, are we going to consider only the real economy in the United States, which I think is very difficult to do in an interconnected world? But you do have the potential for massive economic activity coming into the next 2-3 years of a Trump administration. And to me, it's very much like the Chinese circa 2010, 2011, where the central bank stimulus was 4 times greater than ours relative to GDP, and it did drive some economic activity. Now, I would argue that it drove more malinvestment, but that was still economic activity. And we're likely to see the same over the next 4 years. Of course, our transition is away from central bank monetary policy and towards the helicopter money, which is your fiscal policy spends. And we're moving back towards, again, something that will drive economic activity. But what is the difference between economic activity and malinvestment? You get to find that out after the fact, not before. And I think going back to this idea of classic Keynesian demand management, which is what we're going to get with right. fiscal policy spending, the question is, will Keynesian demand management work in this period of time? We know that certain economic models do work in certain environments. And is this going to be more or less like the 70s? If it is like the 70s and you've got an inflationary bias over the next 3, 4, 5 years, then I don't think a Keynesian demand management program is going to work. It's not going to give you positive results. The caveat here is that while we can see a short spurt of economic activity, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have follow through in terms of a long-term growth trend. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the stock market continues to march higher. Buy the rumor, sell the news is a pretty classic Wall Street mantra. And we've had this notion that we're going to cut taxes and there's going to be massive fiscal spending. And a lot of that has been priced into the Dow at 20,000. Sell the news means once we see the projects that are going to be proposed and they're being initiated, maybe they're disappointing in terms of their net effect, which means that we got way out in front of our skis in terms of the stock market being priced where it is.
Well, as an indicator for the economy, don't be fooled by the stock market hitting new highs. We've learned that over and over and over. So, all right, this is an unusual question, Dave, and I think it's an interesting question. I think probably we ought to look at the next 5, 6, 7 decades if you're talking this direction. But listen to this. Howdy, David and Kevin. I enjoy listening to your commentary because you keep a real perspective on evolving trends. The cost of getting into space is dropping. Mining and returning it home will not cost as much considering artificial intelligence and robotics. What are your thoughts on the balance of scarcity in metals as we enter the space age? Best regards, DJ.
Yeah, I think one of the things that would have to change significantly are the technologies involved in mining. Today, it's an issue of scale. When you look at a successful mine operation, the scale is absolutely staggering. I mean, consider even just the size of the trucks involved in moving material from one place to another,
right,
where the trucks themselves are 3 to 4 stories tall, where a single tire on that truck is a $100,000 tire. It's a scale that boggles the mind. So to try to reproduce that in space, I think would be a challenge. I think you could see small scale success, and that would be possible on some sort of a interstellar basis, if you will.
Well, and if I can comment just a moment on this, Dave, space has always been an interest to me. And, you know, we're still at about $10,000 per pound to loft a pound into space. So even when the astronauts on the ISS are picking their Thanksgiving meal, okay, it's tens of thousands of dollars as they just loft a single meal up there. Now, that doesn't mean it's not going to change, but there still is a high cost to getting to space. The other thing, too, is when you look at the mineral richness in space, you know, granted, there are asteroids that have various minerals, sometimes even precious metals in them. But, you know, it's estimated they have just found that about every 100,000 years per 100,000 stars, there's a single impact of 2 neutron stars, which supposedly creates gold. Okay. And of course, we won't go into all the physics of it, but you know, the atomic elemental scale, you can get into the heavier elements as you start having some of these cataclysmic events in space. But you know, you figure 100,000 years, 100,000 stars, the odds of actually getting to that are very, very low. And actually, Dave, the thing that's more valuable than anything in space right now, and far more valuable than if someone found a lot of gold or platinum, is actually just water. Because water, you can manufacture fuel to go to Mars. You can manufacture air. You can actually have the water that it takes to give to astronauts, or just the basic mechanisms. Water is an amazing thing. And so water actually is what they're going for, at least in the next couple of decades. And it's fascinating to watch, and they are finding water right now. It's just very, very expensive to get there.
So you're really addressing a more considerable issue, which is that gold and discovery of gold remains an exploration problem. And the odds of discovery are significantly lower in space than here on Earth. So even if you could overcome the exploration issue, you still have the issue of scale. Frequency of trips back and forth, the weight involved, $10,000 per pound, and maybe it's reduced to $1,000 per pound. it still has to make sense in terms of the all-in costs, and that's a long way off. So perhaps if we're thinking about sort of a 100-year perspective,
right,
there's a lot of things that have changed between now and the end of the next 100 years, which make it more feasible, but it's difficult to imagine from this vantage point.
This next question comes from Jim. David and Kevin, Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution prohibits the states from making, quote, anything but gold and silver coin, a tender, in payment of debts, end quote. Is it not unconstitutional that we're not using gold and silver as money? Are we, the United States of America, not a state as well? I would hope that constitutional lawyers have discussed this question, but I've never heard or seen any discussion along this line. Dave, Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution. My memory is that it keeps the states from manufacturing their own money except for gold and silver. But what's your comment on that?
Well, I think one, you're talking about a congressional responsibility to create our money, and that control has been delegated to the Federal Reserve by Congress. Instead of the creation of gold and silver as our coinage, they've allowed the Federal Reserve to make Federal Reserve notes.
Right.
And I think one of the issues when you're looking at Article 1, Section 10, it has to do with how we pay debts. When you read it line by line, there is a prohibition against states creating their own legal tender.
Right.
And that is a part of the issue.
Their own paper money, legal tender.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there is a requirement that debts be paid in gold and silver.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue there is that our founders had an understanding that fiat money was a fraud.
Right.
And that you could create an infinite amount of it. And if you were allowed to pay off your debts with fiat money, that it would undermine the credibility of a credit and debit system.
Boy, good thing that hasn't happened, Dave, since we've gone to a fiat system, huh?
Yeah, I think Article 1, Section 10, it's a prohibition against a state signing its own treaties. It's a prohibition against coining its own money. It's a prohibition against granting titles of nobility. I can't remember all the things that are listed there, but there are things that it says that you cannot do. And the point on gold and silver is that debts need to be honored with something of more or less constant value versus inflatable fiat.
Yeah, it's the concept that we see in the Bible of just weights, just measures. That's how things were supposed to be paid. Next question from Bruce. David, do you think a third political party could arise out of the populism of the Trump victory? I personally would like to see this. There really is little difference between the Republican Party and the Democrats. Do you think there'll be a third party, or have we already experienced that, Dave? Trump's not really a Republican, is he?
Well, there was something of sort of a third party move with Trump, and he essentially hijacked the Republican Party temporarily.
Right.
So, I mean, an interesting thought experiment is, in his second term, perhaps as an incumbent, Trump runs on his own party and says,
the Trump party.
Yeah, to hell with the Republicans. I don't need you. And whatever he calls it, it won't be the Bull Moose party. But
it might be the Bull something party.
Yeah, it could be the Bull in the China shop party. Yeah, and that he'll have a good record of sort of preparing for. But I think to eliminate the math conundrum of a third party, you need both a second liberal socialist alternative and a second conservative constitutionalist party, because what you're going to have running the sort of the fear in the minds of the voters and the electorate is we're going to be throwing away our vote. We've just divided the conservative vote and you've got a unified liberal vote and you can't win. You cannot win if you divide the conservative vote. So the fear of math, the only way you solve that is by having more than just a third party, but probably a third and fourth party.
Right.
And so that could be interesting. I think when you look at what Bernie Sanders represented, which was more of a socialist leaning liberal than a centrist leaning liberal, it says that there are a good number of people out there that would have voted for a third party liberal candidate. And we already know that there's plenty of people who would vote for a third party conservative candidate.
Right.
And then a bunch of people who, again, would feel like I'm not throwing away my vote if, in fact, the math works, dividing by four instead of dividing by three.
Next question from Bruce. If the elite are planning to basically destroy our economy so that they can control us, is it possible to do what Doug Nolan suggested in the commentary, to get back to capitalism and to get central banks out of the financial markets? Now, I realize this is conspiracy thinking, but I believe it's real. I'm not a fatalist, but don't you think that it would be difficult until we expose this dynamic?
Well, I think there's earlier stages of the economy that were not as finance-centric, and there might be future stages that, again, reduce the prominence of the finance sector, which we see today. And, you know, the reality is that Trump is going to have a difficult time re-engineering DC's interactions with the markets.
Right. Well, we're already seeing the implications with Goldman Sachs and some of the guys still in the picture.
Yeah. So what does that look like? Does he allow for freer markets? My lingering fear, and you and I have had many conversations about this, Kevin, is that the wheels come off in our over-leveraged financial system while, quote unquote, Mr. Business is in office. And that ends up creating a stigma against free markets for at least a generation. I see that there is a tremendous amount of hope tied to entrepreneurial problem solving. And I see that America can not only be great, but greater if we allow for entrepreneurial problem solving to be a part of the reconstruction and the reorientation of our economic life.
So you'd hate to see false blame go to Trump necessarily because of when he came into the markets and when they came apart.
That's right. And you get false attribution when someone's elected at a market low, and you get false blame when someone is elected at a market peak. And so my concern remains that we are in this period where capitalism may actually be blamed for the suffering that is in sort of a second round of a global financial crisis. And if capitalism is blamed, then, you know, not only do central banks gain the upper hand, but central planning gains the upper hand for multiple generations.
The next question comes from Mike. Back when silver and gold were hitting their last highs in 2011, and gold was $1,900, the Dow gold ratio was 4.5 to 1. Why did we not get out of gold and go into the stock market, which has gone up since? Now, Dave, did we ever really get to 4 or 5 to 1?
Not quite. We got close. 6.36 was August of 2011. And so let's call it 6 to 1 at the outside. And to answer the first question, well, sure, we should have. Hindsight's 2020. Should we have gotten out at 1900 and be buying back now at 1100? That would be brilliant. There were a number of things that were not clear at the time and, in fact, have not changed in the interim. And that is Europe fixed? Are the ramifications of overlending and bad decisions in terms of credit quality, have those problems been addressed in Europe? The answer is no. And as we got to 2011, of course, June of 2011 was when we were at sort of the worst point of emotional crisis in Europe.
Right.
Here in the United States, things were getting marginally better and relatively better because we went into the crisis first. And so things looked a lot worse in Europe than they did in the United States. China looked to be the brightest light coming out of the global financial crisis because, as we mentioned in reference to one of the earlier questions, China spent 4 times relative to their GDP what we did in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. And all the economic statistics showed that on that basis, they were recovering much faster. And the dialogue amongst folks at the Financial Times, The Economist, and a few other papers was that, in fact, command and control dynamics are more important than capitalism in this era. And we have a lot to learn from China because the free markets actually should be trusted less and the minds of the Politburo should be trusted more. So
right.
Can we hatch our own version of the Politburo? That was actually being discussed in 2011. Critical of capitalism and very much in favor of command and control dynamics. Again, looking at central bank activity on the largest scale ever witnessed in history, relative to the size of the economy, they're orchestrated by the Chinese. Well, now we have 2020 hindsight on that issue as well. And we see that, in fact, they're struggling to maintain their growth trajectory. And they have massive debt issues, which have yet to be resolved, which means that what they, in effect, did in that 2010, 11, and 12 timeframe in China was paper over a significant problem. So here we are, circa 2016, and we've papered over the problems in Europe. We've papered over the problems in the United States. We've papered over the problems in China. And we haven't met these challenges with any real structural change or reform. What typically happens in a market cycle is that bad bets get wiped out. It's almost like a mismanaged forest, right? You get too much undergrowth which leads to too much tender, which leads to a bigger burn than you would have had otherwise. But guess what? Even then, you have the possibility for rebirth, regeneration, and new growth. And we're not in that position today, in large part because we've had massive amount of central bank intervention precluding real declines in asset values and a wipeout of bad debts.
Well, and 6-to-1 has never been a goal. 5-to-1 has never been a goal. If you really look at market tops going back to 1896, the 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 has typically been the top of the market. That's what we've seen. You have to remember what your target is. 6-to-1 would not have been a target. That would not have been a trigger.
No, that's exactly right. So 4-to-5-to-1 become more compelling if you're heavy gold to start a reduction process, but not necessarily get out altogether. You go back to the crisis of 1907. We were just above a 2-to-1 as we headed just into the roaring 20s, but still sort of on a war footing. 1915, we were at about a 3-to-1 ratio. In the context of the Great Depression, by February of 1933, we're at about a 2-to-1 ratio. I think we touched down in the high twos, 2-point-something in 1932.
Right.
And then in February of 33, we're at a 2-to-1 ratio. But if we look at the most interesting period of time, if you're looking for a parallel to the present, the 1970s to 1980 period, 1974, we hit a 3-to-1 ratio. That was off a peak of 27 or 28-to-1 on the ratio. Sort of January 1966 was that peak. Declines to a 3-to-1, and then it backs up to over 8-to-1. And it looks like the bull market is over. Everything's done. You should have traded out at 3-to-1. And lo and behold, we find ourselves at a 1-to-1 ratio, 1.29, by the time we get to January of 1980. So it's a very fair question, Mike. And the issue is 6-to-1 was never an exit point, never even a reduction point in our world, in our perspective. 3-to-1, 2-to-1, 1-to-1, certainly looking at the past as predicate to the future to some degree, we expect to find the last and final leg of a secular bull market in the precious metals. And that remains ahead of us. We had the first leg, which was from 2000 to 2003. That took the ratio from the 40s down to the 20s. The second leg of the bull market in gold took the Dow gold ratio. This is 2005 to 2011. Took it from the 20s down to 6. But again, where you find a 3 or a 2 or a 1-to-1 ratio is when the public comes into the market. Why has the public not come into the gold market yet? Well, in part because you had a fantastic PR campaign proving to the world that everything would be fine. We saw that in Europe where Draghi said basically, I will do whatever it takes.
Right, which meant printing money.
And it relieved the tensions within the market. It allayed the fears in the market, but has done nothing to fix the problem. So the problem remains. And now central banks have more obligations. Banks and corporations have more obligations. The whole world is more leveraged today than it was prior to the global financial crisis. And leverage was the issue in 08 and 09. So where are we at and where are we going? We do think we have the third leg still ahead of us. And it just, I can't think of a single instance in market history, and this would be commodities markets, stock markets, real estate markets, markets of any kind, where the public does not ultimately come into the market. And so that does mark the last phase of a bull market. Did we begin that in 2016? We may very well have begun a transition from a cyclical bear 2011 to the present, not unlike the cyclical bear that we had from December of 74 through 76, about a 2-2.5 year bear market in the 70s before that final blow off phase when the public most certainly did come into the market and was fully invested by the time January 1980 rolled around.
The next question comes from Johan in Australia. I have not missed one podcast for a very long time now. I really appreciate and enjoy the program. Thanks for the hard work you put into it. I realize those things don't just happen, but it takes dedication and hard work. Question. I hold physical silver and am a true believer in holding the real stuff and not paper silver or gold. Recently, I have learned of goldmoney.com. And that you can own real gold with them and have a debit card so that you can use it for transactions. Now, I have family in South Africa and need to transfer money from time to time to assist family members. Transfer costs are high, and I was thinking of using gold money, but it scared me that it might be paper gold and not the real thing. Is it the real thing, and is it safe to use and invest in?
Yeah, so there's an interesting backstory to gold money. Jim Turk is the founder of Gold Money, and he recently sold that to a Canadian company who've sort of consolidated the digital gold universe. And so they've got three parts that are now one part. Turk's company was very intriguing. They did sell real physical metals, and you gained ownership in a fractional way in a 400-ounce good delivery bar.
Right. You know,
it's very difficult to take delivery of a 400-ounce good delivery bar. So if you ever did want the gold, there was a cost to convert and things like that. I believe that it still is that way. I haven't tracked the new gold money, but assuming that it's similar, I would believe what Jim Turk set in motion is pretty legitimate. Next year, we are, as a company, offering something similar. We've preferred a different custody location, and we've preferred a different product mix, giving a little bit more flexibility to the person who has the asset.
And you're staying away from the 400-ounce bars and moving to something much smaller.
That's right, preferring kilos instead. So there's something that I think we'll be discussing probably June of next year in that regard. And for the same reasons, we look at physical gold and we say, you know, would prefer to have physical gold in our possession. That is taking metals outside of the financial sphere, making the asset private, and putting you in direct control over the asset with no counterparties involved, with no layers of technology being helpful to you from the transactional standpoint, but also harmful to you in the event that the lights go out. So there are advantages and disadvantages to this. And what I would prefer to sort of position this as, when you think of gold money, when you think about our offering in 2017, I prefer to think of it as a substitute for a savings account or a banking alternative, where you may choose to designate your ounces or your cash in ounces. And a part of our program next year, you'll be able to decide if you want market volatility or not. In
right.
other words, do you want a hedged gold position? Or do you want a gold position that fluctuates every day with the price of gold?
Well, and it doesn't replace the physical gold ownership like what you're saying. It replaces the cash side. Do you want cash to be in fiat or do you want it to be in gold?
That's right. So if I choose a cash alternative and replace my savings account or bank account with kilo bars, but then hedge that position where I have no price change in the position, it does cost me something to do that. But then I can have an ounce position that doesn't fluctuate in value. And you can treat it like a cash position. How? Through the same mechanisms, a credit card, a debit card, which transact to an actual account. So that to me does make sense. There is a role for gold as a cash alternative and accessing it through 21st century technologies. So I like the concept of transaction friendly approaches. We've looked at our competition in that space potentially and have said we can actually do something better. And so that's what we're going to do. I have no high criticism of gold money, but I just think we can do something even better in the process.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Be sure to tune in next week to hear the remaining questions that you sent to us answered. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can always call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.